Congratulations.
Welcome to the June 26th, 2013 Tacoma Landmarks Preservation Commission meeting. First item on the agenda is roll call. Commissioners Heckley, Elquist, Luce, Steele, York, and ex officio Buffington and McClintock are present. Chair House is delayed in traffic. He's on his way, he says. Item two on the agenda, consent agenda, excusable of absences. Commissioners Chase and Jensen have called in. Move for approval of the consent agenda. All in favor say aye.
Are you going to talk about meeting minutes?
Oh, meeting minutes, sorry. Any changes or?
I'd like to request a change for the minutes of June 12th.
On
page four, under the discussion of the property at 100 North Grant. On page four, the second paragraph from the bottom, the very last sentence in that paragraph, I'd like to have changed to read, Commissioner Buffington complimented Mr. Mundell on all the work that had been done on the house, but emphasized that the retroactive request could have been avoided. Currently, it looks like I was complimenting him on not getting a permit. So I'll pass that along to him.
All right, all in favor of the minutes as submitted with the changes, say aye.
Aye.
Item three, board briefing, Fort Nisqually Greenery. Please join us at the table. Great.
My side kick wasn't me.
So down at the bottom.
At the bottom, thank you. Okay, on the PowerPoint.
So are you?
There we go.
Okay. Just want me to get started?
Okay. Hi, you may remember me, Melissa McGinnis from Metro Parks. And tonight, we just wanted to bring to you a project that we started to work on at Fort Nisqually on the granary. The granary is one of the two original structures at Fort Nisqually. It is a registered National Historic Landmark and built in 1850. And so I'm just going to give you a little bit of background on it. I'm sure a lot of you probably already, this is one of the oldest photographs. Like I said, the building was actually constructed in 1850 by the Hudson's Bay Company at Fort Nisqually. Its construction is actually quite well documented in what we have called the Journal of Occurrences, which were the daily records of business at Fort Nisqually, and we do have a copy of those at the fort. And from July through December of 1850, they talk about quite a few of our different French-Canadian employees, as well as some Hawaiians and Native Americans, were recorded squaring timbers and working. And at that point, what they were building in 1850 was the new granary, because there had been an older one. Fort Nisqually was actually established in 1833, but they had just a few years earlier moved from their first site down on the beachfront up a mile inland up to Sequalchie Creek. And so at that time, the powers that be decided that they needed a new granary, a building to store grains and produce, because we were the headquarters of what was called the Puget Sound Agricultural Company. So farming was a huge part of Fort Nisqually's business. This photograph is taken, like say, around 1890. The building is still in the DuPont area, which was the original location of Fort Nisqually. And one of the things, if you notice the these little creatures, if you can't see, it's kind of a rough photograph. These are chickens, and they are actually one of the reasons the granary survived today. Most of Fort Nisqually's original buildings just simply eroded away over time. They were wooden buildings in Washington without any sort of preservative, and that's kind of what happens around here. But the two buildings that did survive into the 21st century are the Granary and the Factor's House. The Factor's House survived because Edward Huggins lived there. It was his home, so when the roof leaked, he fixed it. When the window broke, he fixed it, as he maintained and took care of the building. He did the same thing with the Granary because it was his chicken coop. So thanks to Edward and his chickens, we have the Granary today. And so this is a picture just a couple of years later. This is 1915. That's Ezra Meeker sitting there in the doorway of the Granary. One of the things that all the pictures show is that archway over the door, which a lot of people have always questioned if that's original. Well, it comes through and everything, so I feel pretty confident about it. But what has happened between 1890 and 1915 is Edward Huggins, who was the homesteader, he was a Hudson's Bay Company employee, he was the clerk at Fort Nisqually. When Fort Nisqually closed down in 1870, Edward Huggins did not get his promotion with the Hudson's Bay Company, and so he said, okay, I want to be an American now, and so I'm an American, and I think I'm going to claim the Homestead Act, and I want this to be my homestead. And so he actually claimed the land around Fort Nisqually's headquarters, and he lived there until 1901, I believe, and he then sold it to the DuPont Company. So DuPont moves in, and they are making explosives down there. They've got all kinds of different buildings going up. And if you look at this building from Edward's chicken coop, they're not taking as good a care of it as Edward did, as his chicken coop. You've got some graffiti on the walls even, and it's just starting to run down a little bit. And essentially what happens is that the DuPont Company got tired of people, probably like you folks from the Landmarks Commission, who wanted to go see old Fort Nisqually buildings, and they wanted to go to the original site of Fort Nisqually, and they got tired of you tromping around their dynamite building facility. It just wasn't particularly safe. So they basically said, if somebody doesn't come take these buildings off our hands, we're going to tear them down. And that's when Metro Parks got involved, the State Historical Society got involved, and trying to save these two original buildings, knowing they had to get them off their original location. So the decision was made that Metro Parks would give the land for them in Point Defiance Park, a recently cleared point of Point Defiance Park, and there would be help from what was called the Young Men's Business Club, the a forerunner of our Chamber of Commerce, and they raised the money to dismantle the buildings and move them to Point Defiance. That happens in the 1930s. The nice thing about the Granary is it's built in a style of construction called post and sill, or post on sill, or there's a French name that I don't pronounce well. But it's essentially a giant Lincoln log building, which makes it very conducive for taking it apart and putting it together another location, which is one of the reasons that the Hudson's Bay Company used this style of construction so often. So the post, basically the sill beam along the bottom, the corner, and sill beam and post along the way, and then infill beams, and you just kind of stack the building up. You can move your windows where you want them. You can do all kinds of things, and it's a very simple form of construction. So in 1934, the Granary can be seen there on the far left-hand side. The first thing that happened was simply to relocate those two buildings, was to get them to Point Defiance, get them safe, get them put back together. And then there are different work relief things through the WPA and CCC and state Washington relief efforts provided additional funding to recreate some of those missing Fort Nisqually buildings. And so that's what you see with the WPA doing here, is starting to reconstruct some of the missing buildings around those two original historic structures. And this is when I just had to pull this one in here because it's kind of fun to have a picture that's very, very, very rarely seen. Because here's the Granary. This is right after things are put in place at the fort. You can see some new wood here on the bottom. Some of the sill beams had replaced even at this point. We're not in good enough shape. But you can see right next door to it, the blacksmith shop, you know, all new lumber. There's a little bit of contrast there. But this particular building lasted very, very few years. It's been gone since late, probably 1930s, 1938, 39. They tore it right down. It's obviously, there's a car parked in the garage, because right over here was the caretaker's house for the fort. So they actually gave the caretaker a garage, I guess, right in the beginning. I have no idea when, you know, It just went right down, because future pictures right after this show it gone in a big hole right there. So for whatever reason, they didn't want the caretaker's car inside anymore. And the same basic view today, there's your blacksmith shop, the new building that was constructed in the 30s. Then you've got the Granary and the sales shop, or the trade store, which was also built in the 30s. And there's our little Granary. And, you know, for all intents and purposes, other than a little mold on the roof, a little moss on the roof, it isn't looking too bad until you start looking a little bit closer. And then you start noticing that these infill beams are starting to pull away from those upright posts. You've got some separation going on with the wood. This is a little hard to see here. There we go. These are the pins holding the roof, the trusses together, and you can see some pulling apart up on the roof area. There was a stabilization, an earlier stabilization effort done to the building in 1984, and at that point in time, these metal stripping was put into the roof to try to help stabilize the building at that time. What we've learned from Wilson is it really isn't adequate for what we really need because the building is still shifting. Again, another example of the, you can see the sill beams are pulling away from these posts. We're starting to separate, the building's starting to separate. These are the ones that are a little nerve-wracking because these are actually up over your head. When these start pulling away, those tie beams start pulling away from the plate timbers, just a little bit close up as it starts to separate. As we've noticed this starting, this shift going on within the building, there were some intermediate remedies that were put in place. One, these are metal tie bars that were run across to try to hold the building's walls together so those beams don't fall down on your head. And it was somewhat convenient because the holes were already there. This is the same method they used in the 1960s when the building started to pull apart before the 1984 stabilization. And I guess what we're kind of discovering is that 1984 stabilization just didn't go far enough. It put some reinforcement in the walls, it tied the foundation a little bit, but it really didn't tie the top part of it, and that's what we're going to fix this time, right?
That's right.
We're going to fix the roof this time. And so we've got the tie beams we put back in to hold those walls together, and when Reuben came out to visit, he agreed this is the most annoying part of our little safety measure. These upright posts are simply put in place to hold this up here from falling on your head. And so it really distorts your view of how that space should be used, spatially how the building was used.
Makes you think it's a barn.
Yes, it was a barn. It was just simply a storage area is all that it was. And that's how you can see it is used today interpretively, is to display the farming implements and so forth to get people that sense of Fort Nisqually as a farm. And also, not only is it a National Historic Landmark, so we're very concerned about caring for the building, but as far as the board's concerned, it's a key element to our interpretive programming. Not only do we talk about the agricultural side of the fort, but we also talk about the architecture. It's a great starting point to talk to people about architecture, and because this one is a very classic Hudson's Bay Company, there are only two Hudson's Bay post and seal buildings left in the United States. One's in Montana at Fort Kana, and then we have the other one. So it was a very simple way that a French-Canadian paddleist, you do not have to be a great carpenter to build a post and seal building. Okay, you have to be able to make logs square, but other than that, notch the ends. It's not very complicated, whereas when you get to the granary, the factor's house, the other original building, that's when we finally have lumber mills here in the area, and so it's clapboard and a very much more modern building, and no one believes it's the other original building to the fort because of its construction style. So it's really, the two buildings are great to work together interpretively for that. So basically, when we realized the building was falling apart, not falling apart, but pulling apart gently, gradually, and making us nervous with loose beams over our heads, first thing we did out at the fort was we talked to some folks at the National Park Service, and historic architect Lauren Huffman came down, looked at the building, and said, you know what you guys need? You need a structural engineer. You need a structural engineer to look at this building and see just what's going on, see what you need to do to repair it. And that's when we called Wilson from BCRA. So if you don't know Wilson, he has been doing the work on this. I'm going to turn it over now and let them know what you want to do.
Great.
And let's see, let me get to the end of this so you can get to your pictures if you'd like. Initial. Okay, there we go. Come on. What would you give it a minute?
It's on 200%, so you may want to reduce it.
Oh, go down in size.
Go down. What do you, go ahead. Oh, there we go. There we go. Okay. And off work.
So we did the analysis on the building to kind of look at how it would perform on today's code standards for winds and for seismic, for gravity. And gravity, mostly it was a snow condition that we were concerned about. And what we found is any one particular event, seismically, discounted, but
for the snow and the wind, if they were happening separately, they probably wouldn't take the building down, but if you combine, based on our codes today, we had to combine loads. We had to combine the wind and the snow, and the roof structure itself was not going to be able to take the loads of the building. Now, it wasn't so much of a concern, per se, that...
I did the wrong thing.
You're starting to be so sly.
So the roof structure was really what we were mostly concerned about. The structure is pretty stout and heavy, so from the earthquake standpoint, it kind of, with enough friction, it's going to hold itself in place. But from the wind and the snow condition, we were concerned that if you ever had that condition, it would just take the roof off. I mean, it would just collapse it in on itself. Now, you could argue that there's these walls next to it and there's this cliff, but we ultimately were looking at it from the standpoint of, okay, if we were going to keep this for a long time, what's the best thing to do? And what we decided on was we would upgrade the roof. And what we designed in was these steel members that kind of resemble the trusses or A-frame that you see that was existing, and these would kind of supplement the existing framing members. Additionally, we added steel members along the what we call the plate, the top plate there and the top plate here, to help stabilize basically the whole roof. We gave a new skeleton to the roof is really all we wound up doing. And if you think about the Lincoln Log scenario, if you just push on Lincoln Logs without the roof on it, the big red roof, those Lincoln Logs want to shift quite a bit. And what we've done is tied it all together now with the roof structure, the nice stiff plastic piece in the Lincoln Logs, but we've done it now with the steel framing, and that will hold that whole thing nice and stiffened together so that that roof won't push out on the walls anymore, and we'll be able to take the snow and the wind load that we have. Now, it is not going to necessarily withstand a large magnitude of earthquake. It's going to shift a little bit, and it may fall off its foundations and stuff like that. But from the standpoint of from engineering side, we didn't feel that was the big risk involved here. It's a small building, and you know, generally wood buildings perform fairly well under seismic loads. They have enough move to them. It would probably move, but it may need to be shifted back, or pieces of it may shift. But generally speaking, we felt like the earthquake seismic was not going to be too bad. So we just fixed the roof, and that's all we're really proposing to do.
Do I see a metal frame all the way around the perimeter at the top of the walls?
Yes, this black thing here?
Yeah.
Yes, that is a metal frame that goes, you can see. So effectively, we have a metal frame around the... that rings the top of the roof, and most of it will be on top of the existing top plate, so you won't quite be able to see it. In this view, you can kind of see a little bit better what it is. You can see the black. It'll be on top of the existing top plate. And then we've also now incorporated some ties using those pieces that we were afraid of falling down. That was one of Ruben's concerns, if we could get rid of those posts. And there's nothing loading those beams other than the push out of the roof. Now that we've solved the push out of the roof, we now also use that to tie across the building. So we're using its original member to tie across the building so that it helps also prevent the kick out of the walls. That's what this view is.
So are you replacing all the skip sheathing on the building?
No, we are not touching the skip sheathing.
Okay.
So the skip sheathing wasn't working for load purposes, so that's why we proposed to put something in between so that it would support on every, well, it'd have half the span now, so we didn't have to replace it. That's part of why we put it in between versus sistering up or something.
Okay. And then the coil strap that was added on the 1984 upgrade, or mm-hmm. I think that's what you said. It looked like the coil strap was added above the skip sheathing.
Correct.
And you're proposing the same with the coil strap that you're using for the roof diaphragm?
I'm not touching. We're not adding. That's the same one. Yep, we're just
Got
leaving
it.
That in place. We're not adding any further.
So you're just adding the secondary rafters and the
ring
plate.
Yeah, the ring plate, basically.
Got it.
It is getting a new roof. but it is a 1984 roof, so the shingles have been replaced numerous times in its life. So it's going to get, that's the other thing it's getting.
Yeah, and there's a maintenance program that we've been talking about to keep the bugs out. 10 years ago, they did a complete kind of station.
It was a major treatment to it for the carpet.
And they'll just keep an eye on it, make sure that you don't have any bugs going back in it. But the wood is really generally solid. I mean, you got some punky areas, but very minorly punky. It's just a solid building. If you get the chance to walk up in there and jump around a little bit, it's a solid building. So
he keeps telling us it's real heavy.
It is very heavy. I mean, all that wood is heavy. And part of why it survived so many years is it has the ability to get wet and dry versus just getting wet and staying wet. And so it's been able to dry, even though it might get wet sometimes. And I think, Melissa, you were telling me this is the only building that out there that's original that doesn't actually have a leaking roof.
It does not leak at all. And it's pretty amazing because you can look up and look at the sky.
Yeah, you can see the sky,
the opening
but
and
it
the
doesn't
shingles,
leak.
But it never, ever leaks. It's a really great design.
Mirrors.
So is the assumption that the pulling away of the posts and so forth was a result of the roof, or are there some other factors in there?
The large majority of the roof is due to the roof. The A-frame that is there has a tie about mid-level, but it still pushes on the walls laterally outwards. So yes, that was kind of pushing it out. The rods have stabilized it, and if we did a measurement on the building to see how straight it was, and it's actually pretty straight. It does kick out at the tops of the walls. It does bow out. It doesn't bow out so significantly that I would recommend trying to pull it all back together. I would probably just say, just let's leave it so that we don't kind of...
But it wasn't a foundation, probably.
When they built the new foundation at Fort Nisqually at Point Defiance there, they did a real good job of leveling it out.
Granite, I mean, stones under it.
Yeah, it's nice and level and flat. It was quite amazing measuring this thing, how straight it was. So they did a good job back there. Any other questions?
Nope. Very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And before I leave, though, because I know you all want to come out and see Fort Nisqually, and if you haven't done that recently, I have so much propaganda. I was going to give it to Tony to pass out because it's our calendar events, but we also on weekends have a great program called Crafts of the Past. So if you want to know about banjo making or Punch and Judy puppetry, we've got your weekend for you. This is our just standard little rack card to make you want to come to Fort Nisqually. And then if you just need to get out and relax, because I know you've been to this one before, we have a fundraiser for the fort last Friday in July called Friday at the Fort, but it's not your kind of music anymore, I'm afraid. It's the Shy Boys Rock and Roll from Gig Harbor. So, but good Seven Seas beer, wine, and food. So it's a good Friday after work kind of thing to do. So love to see you. And also, if at any point in time the Landmark Commission would like to come out and get a walkthrough of the granary and do anything like that, just, you know, let Ruben know, and we'll be happy to set something up for you. Thanks.
Thank you.
All right. Well, moving on. Item number 4, Board Business Preservation Planning. Demolition by Neglect Ordinance.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. So before I start, I just want to note that this item, at this point, although the staff report went out last week, at this point I'm not asking the commission for any sort of recommendation or approval of this. We're actually backing slightly off the schedule to allow us to have more time for public input on some of the aspects of this ordinance, and so as a result of that, there are things that are going to change. We've already had some changes to draft already, so it really is not quite the right time to ask the commission to formally recommend this. So instead, I thought that since it was the draft is already in the packet, I go over where we're at with it and what the how I guess the mechanics of it work, and invite comments and feedback. So. Where I last briefed the commission on this, I talked to, I think it was a conceptual briefing to discuss the development of a demolition by neglect ordinance, and since then we've come quite a bit farther to the point where you can see this document, the one on the landmarks packet, is draft 12. Most of those are formatting changes and things like that, but we've gone through quite a few as this goes through the different departmental contacts on this. And so, at any rate, where we ended up is that we're proposing, or going to propose, I guess you'd say, an additional chapter to be added to the Title 8 of the Municipal Code, which is Public Safety and Morals, and creating a section that declares neglected historic buildings to be public nuisances. There's two enforcement procedures or codes in the city. One's under the nuisance code and one is under the minimum building structures code. If you recall last time I was here, we talked a little bit about that. The minimum building structures code is in the building code. It is based on state law, which very clearly identifies a process and procedures for dealing with what are called unfit buildings in state law and what we call our minimum building structures code, dangerous or derelict. The point of creating a demolition by neglect prevention ordinance is to allow the city to have tools to intervene in cases of neglect prior to them becoming dangerous. So that the, as everybody probably knows, the farther along you get into a process of the building's decline, the more expensive it gets and the higher the risk that the building's demolished becomes. And so the city also has the authority under state law to abate and to enforce against nuisances. And so what we've done here is we've created a section on the nuisance code. If you look, 8.31020 declares the neglect of a building, a historic building, which is important for the general public welfare because of economic reasons, for safety, of course, for the cultural identity of the city, that neglect of these buildings is a nuisance. I apologize for the typo, there's a misnumber in there. The scope of this ordinance is right now applied to properties that are listed individually on the Tacoma Register of Historic Places and National Register, as well as contributing properties within historic districts. What is not included at this time is conservation district properties or single-family residential, and I'll get to that in a second. The definitions, of course, are taken from various points of the municipal code and are fairly straightforward. This is not designed to be a very big ordinance, unlike the minimum building structures code, which is probably 30 pages long. Neglected historic properties fall under the definition of, there's a list of substandard property conditions here. They go from everything from unstable architectural elements to leaning, sagging walls, deteriorated surfaces, and so forth. The next section is penalties on enforcement. And basically, this defines historic property neglect as a public nuisance, but then follows the public nuisance abatement process that's already established in 8.30, so it ties into that. But then it also has a couple of other potential procedures. One is that the city may enter and repair or correct conditions that threaten the integrity of the building, and then abate them and then lien them according to the nuisance code and state law. And the process that that uses is what's called a material mens or a mechanics lien, which is has a lifespan of 2 years. And so it's a little different than abating dangerous buildings, which under state unfit code is a, I think it goes through the life of the, until the next property transaction or so forth, it doesn't sunset. And I'll apologize for not knowing all of the mechanics. This is a real cross-departmental effort. This does not also preclude the city from pursuing action as unfit or dangerous in addition to whatever's in this code. And then lastly, one thing that is not in this draft that we're considering is additional penalties or incentives not to neglect your historic building, such as potential for having like if a building were to be demolished, for instance, as a result of neglect, that there may be some penalty for future development on the site for a period of time. And we're working on that language right now, but that's not in this draft currently. And then lastly, of course, we have emergency clause that that makes it clear the relationship between the building official and the Landmarks Commission and the Historic Preservation Officer. And it's the same clause that is already in the Landmarks Code at 1305, that if there's an emergency, we have to take care of it. And so getting back to the scope question, one of the things about this is we're not, well, first of all, this is a pilot. We're going to see how it works, and so we have to define a reasonable application so we can see how well it works and try to implement it successfully. There may be opportunities to adjust or expand depending on how well it works, how often it gets used, what's the need out there. And so we previously, at the last briefing of the commission, I showed an aggressive schedule that was going to take us to City Council on August 6th. We're actually going to back out on that about a month again to allow for additional outreach and public comment, because we were getting, there's many stages in the process. We've been to the Building Board of Appeals on this. We have come to the Landmarks Commission twice. We've been to the Neighborhoods and Housing Committee, and we have other interested stakeholders. So some of the revisions and changes that we're anticipating having as a result of this, we're going to start to back up on one another. And so we just needed to make sure we had an appropriate time to do that. And so at any rate, that's what I have at this point, and I invite any questions or comments. Yes, sir.
Under penalties and enforcement, mm-hmm. If I were the owner of a historic building that were neglected and the city entered and repaired it, I probably first would want to know who's paying for that.
Sure.
And that's not addressed at all here.
Oh, that's a good question. I forgot to mention that. That's actually a critical piece of this, is that the city is going to establish an emergency preservation fund for the purposes. It's not going to be, the idea is we're going to be able to, we're going to protect iconic buildings from neglect and not go after, like, you know, we're not going to be going around and you know, cutting, you know, weeds or things like that, or placing roofs on, you know, on garages, that kind of thing. But really focusing on those sort of critical issues, and it'll be a discretionary, you know, approach as to whether or not that's the appropriate tool. But there will be an emergency preservation fund established. We're going to do that, period. And so we're looking at our different funding sources. They may come out of, you know, one of several possibilities. And then we also have, we're taking a look at what we can do to establish an ongoing revenue piece to that too, so that it doesn't exhaust itself. But it's not going to be, you know, millions of dollars or anything like that. So that's where the money seeded will be. And then the idea is that it will be at some point, hopefully. I mean, the code enforcement is not very economical if you go and proactively abate things. And I'm not aware, actually, that under dangerous buildings, things actually get repaired. I think they usually get demolished. The cost recovery is not a high percentage. I don't know exactly what it is, but for some reason I want to say, you know, 50%, something like that.
I would imagine in some cases if you have, for instance, an out-of-state owner who is just choosing to neglect the property because he has no interest but has funds or has collateral or has something someplace, there will be an opportunity or an ability to go after that person.
Yes.
To collect.
Yes. And the cost recovery there is a cost recovery procedure in the both, I think, in the Dangerous Buildings or Minimum Building Structures Code and in the Nuisance Code as well. The other thing I just want to mention is in the nuisance code abatement also, there's a couple of differences between unfit buildings. In state law, it defines the hearing process. You go to a hearings officer to get the hearing order, then to repair or demolish. And that process is defined in state law. And I'm not an attorney, so I'm gonna try to keep not mess this up and just say anything wrong, so I'll just be kind of general. But that under the nuisance code, to enter and abate a property, the city will obtain a warrant to enter. And so it's not required under the Minimum Building Structures Code enforcement process, because the process is outlined in state law to enter and abate. And in the nuisance, it's not as well written out, or it's a kind of a broad authority thing. So the city generally obtains warrants to do that, and that'll be the process.
You said there'd be a lien on the property for a period of 2 years?
Yes, under, I believe, the state law allows for that type of lien for nuisance abatement is 2 years.
And what happens after 2 years? Does it go away?
I believe it sunsets, yes.
So if the city's paying to fix up someone's house, if they wait out 2 years, then they're not under obligation to pay it back then?
Well, and that's one of that is a consideration, and that's one of the reasons why this is designed to be a sharp tool that is used in specific instances. The abatement piece, I mean, the city under this can still order and introduce civil penalties and so forth to abate, but, you know, if it's necessary and if it's appropriate under this, it provides the city authority also to abate.
So there may be a question as to whether the lien can be renewed.
And that would be a question probably for either our code enforcement folks. I can actually I'll collect those questions and refer them back to code enforcement or our legal team to get answers on that. I don't know the answer to that question.
So one thing that I noticed as I was reading through this was in the scope and applicability section. You mentioned the Tacoma Register and you mentioned the National Register, but in the definitions for city landmark, you only mentioned the Tacoma Register there. And I don't know that you actually use the term city landmark anywhere else. That was what I was sort of frantically looking for. But that you might want to add that to the definition of city landmark of reference to the National Register.
That's a good suggestion. We actually had a couple of other clarifications to be made, and I think that the city landmark definition is hanging out there. And the reason why is because these definitions came out of the Municipal Code 1307, and city landmark is sort of our term of art for
sure.
All buildings, either in historic districts or individually listed on the Tacoma Register. And so it makes this complicated as we've actually, swung that out for National Register. And there are buildings that, talk about iconic buildings, there are a number of buildings that are National Register listed in the city that are not on the Tacoma Register that would be, I would consider critically important to the character of the city. And so, I'm just going to estimate this, but generally speaking, between the Tacoma Register of Historic Places, especially for the Landmarks Register and the Downtown Historic Districts, there's probably about an 80% overlap of, or 80-85% overlap of buildings that are on both registers. There are some that are on the Tacoma Register that don't meet National Register criteria or have not been put on, and then there's some others that were just going for federal tax credit that have not been placed on the Tacoma Register. And then you'll also, there's little differences, like the Old City Hall Historic District, for instance, has one half of the street that is listed on the national but not on the local. It actually extends all the national district line, extends to the center line of St. Helens, whereas it extends only to the center line of Broadway and the local overlay zone. And so, other historic districts. I mean, and the reason why is because they undergo different processes. We go through a public zoning process for our local overlay districts, and that process tends to change boundaries quite a bit. And so you get these little nibbled out pockets and things like that on those districts.
So if I understand this correctly, single-family residential structures are not included, particularly within historic districts. But commercial properties, so for example, apartment buildings,
correct,
would be included. So apartment buildings in the North Slope, for example, would be included.
As it's currently written.
As it's currently written.
There's kind of two thoughts behind that. First of all, the North Slope has what, 950 homes.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I understand the limitation issue. I just wanted to be kind of clear about
sure
what we were including and not, and then commercial buildings.
Mm-hmm.
Of course,
right.
Be included. And I was trying to come up with, trying to stump you. We used to have, we don't have anymore, we used to have three guest houses in the North Slope. And I don't know whether those would be considered single family residential or are they commercial. they still exist in the stadium, National Historic District.
Right.
So might want to puzzle over that a little bit just to sort of see if that's a definition that needs to be worked out a little bit more.
Okay. It's hard to classify uses for human activity.
Oh yeah. No, I totally agree.
Individually, landmarked residents would be excluded, or is it just a residence that was in a district?
Categorically, the idea is that categorically single family dwellings
are out.
Right.
Any other questions or comments?
So, any comments that folks do have, please let me know. We'll be taking them in, and again, working on contacting and running this by interested stakeholders over the next month or so, and then returning back into the actual proposal draft in August.
Very good. All right, item 4B, letter of support, Frank Herbert Parks.
I'll just say that the commission at its last meeting, I believe, voted to prepare a letter of support. That's as the bylaws, it requires the commission vote. The commission took the vote. The letter has been drafted, so this is more provided as an informational item for the chair to sign, unless anybody has any. And Commissioner Ray, if you have anything.
I think we've covered it adequately in previous get-togethers here. It has been pointed out to me that there is a typo in the first sentence, though.
Oh, pleased?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll take care of that.
Okay. I appreciate all the consideration that all of you have put into this. It's going to be a nice addition to the proposal. So.
Item 5, chair comments. As acting chair, I have none.
I have none.
I have a couple of updates that weren't for the commission's information for the good of the order. I just wanted to let the commission know that last night, a couple of things. I was in study session and providing an overview of sort of what's coming up in the historic preservation in terms of program development, and I think Peter Huffman, who's the Director of Planning and Development Services, provided the introductory remarks, and I can sum it up by saying over the next year or so, we're going to be working a lot on delivering a message of preservation, what the public benefits are, sustainability aspects of economic development aspects, and really trying to highlight more about the things that are happening in preservation and work a lot more on the community interest and event side of things, as Peter was saying, taking it to the next level. I think Commissioner Steele was there to watch me bumble, so I don't know if it sparked any thoughts or anything.
I was just there to learn. I did.
I think it was well received, and so it's going to be kind of it's going to be an exciting year going forward, and probably one of the things you're going to see more sooner than later is there is going to be a program newsletter that's going to occur on a quarterly basis. I'm right now working on the design with the Media Communications Office, and so I am going to be soliciting from commissioners both topics of interest and content. I think that it would be a really nice opportunity to elevate the profile of the commission and their and the commission's work. And so look for more for that. The second thing is that yesterday also the City Council, the City Council passed the resolution establishing Mr. Dahl Drive. To great applause from the kids in the audience, we had to get them out of the council chambers, and they were so happy that they had to take them up to the second floor so they could continue to be happy. And so that was a really nice thing. And I think that it's a really, I think, pretty precious learning experience for the kids that were involved to go through the whole governmental process and the review process and the multiple presentations and the hearing all the way up to city council. So, and Grant Carr, if you remember him, has been sort of the spearhead of this the whole time, and the kid's just amazing. So, and secondly, the Kellogg Sicker and H.C. Pochert buildings were also added to the Tacoma Register of Historic Places last night. I would like to also announce that I met the grandson of H.C. Pochert, who provided me with the pronunciation of the last name Pochert. I think he said it was Alsatian or something in the area where the family is, and so he said actually, but you know, half the family is Poche, and then half the family is Pochert. So you really can't go wrong, except that the guy that did that building is Pochert. And he shared with me some memories of back when he was a kid of walking up and down what was then called K Street. Visiting the business there, and so it was just really neat to have them come down. And so, at any rate, so those two things happened, and then I still have historic pavements are on the council schedule right now for August 6th, and I'm trying to think of any other milestones right now. I think that's about it.
Good. Nothing else? We're adjourned.